This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor, dated Friday, June the 5th, 2026. As is my custom, we're going to start in the world section and work our way through as many sections and articles as we can in the time that we have. So, first up from the world section of today's Monitor, the headline reads, "Do Israeli Voters Still Trust Netanyahu?" Benjamin Netanyahu has long presented himself as the best Israeli politician to keep the country safe. But going into another election, some voters have their doubts. The date on this article is June the 5th. It is by Shoshana Solomon, who is a contributor at the Monitor, and Dina Kraft, who is a special correspondent at the Monitor. The datelines are Tel Aviv, Israel, and Washington, D.C. The scene in a new campaign ad is instantly recognizable to Israelis as a reference to the attack by Hamas on October 7, 2023. The camera zooms out from a food-laden family dinner table with half-filled beverage glasses, but no one is in the bullet-riddled, smoldering home. The political message of the ad, put out by a prominent Israeli opposition figure, is clear. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is failing to keep Israelis safe, and it is time for new leadership. Mr. Netanyahu has led the conservative Likud party for most of the last three decades and is Israel's longest-serving prime minister. He currently heads a government that is widely recognized as the most hardline right-wing coalition in Israel's history. Now, the reputation that this prime minister has spent years cultivating as Mr. Security, the core of his political appeal, is under assault. And yet, Mr. Netanyahu remains a political force, analysts say, with outsized skill in creating disparate but highly effective partnerships that help him maintain a grip on power even as his popularity wanes. Israel is in the election season, with voting to be held on October 27th. Opposition politicians, including former Army Chief of Staff Gadi Eisenkot, whose Yashar party released that campaign video, are quick to remind Israeli voters that the October 7th attack happened on Mr. Netanyahu's watch, that the prime minister's often repeated vow to achieve, quote, total victory in Gaza has fallen short, and that Mr. Netanyahu is giving in to pressure from Washington to let up on Hezbollah, the Israel-backed Shiite militia in Lebanon. In the north, we are losing faith, says Daniel Dorfman, a pizzeria owner in a town along Israel's northern border with Lebanon. He says shellings and drone attacks from Hezbollah that resumed in March are making the whole region unlivable. Mr. Dorfman says he voted for Mr. Netanyahu's party in the past because he liked the prime minister's ideology and leadership stature. But now he is thinking about voting for the party of Naftali Bennett, a right-wing contender for the prime minister role, or perhaps the party of Avigdor Lieberman, another longtime right-wing rival to Mr. Netanyahu. Along with many Israelis, Mr. Dorfman says the prime minister still needs to take responsibility for failing to prevent the October 7th attack. In a recent poll released by Israeli news outlet Channel 12, 53% of respondents said that Mr. Netanyahu should not run in the upcoming elections. The prime minister's, quote, inability to bring success on the war front is actually becoming apparent to his own followers, says Gail Talshir, a political scientist at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Hamas is still in Gaza, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and the Ayatollahs in Iran, she says. This is where the people that used to vote for Netanyahu because of security lose their trust. Mr. Netanyahu has always been a political survivor, and when voters are asked who is most suitable to be Israel's prime minister, he still generally performs strongly against main opposition contenders, but that advantage might be eroding. A Channel 12 poll published Thursday, for example, found that Mr. Eisenkot, 38%, had passed Mr. Netanyahu, 35%, as the most suitable for the role of prime minister. He and Mr. Bennett have both outpaced Mr. Netanyahu in some other recent polling, though what will determine the prime minister's hold on power is whether his bloc has enough votes to form a coalition. Mr. Netanyahu's enduring political success stems not so much from love for him, analysts argue, but from his genius in keeping his coalition partners happy and the inability of opposition parties to present one unified candidate around whom voters can focus their attention. There is no agreed leader of the opposition, says Ms. Talshear. Mr. Netanyahu, who is also standing trial on corruption charges, has a very stable base of supporters, as high as 47%, who think he is the best, says Dalia Scheindlin, an Israeli political analyst and pollster. She says the base still believes he has skill, the gravitas, and the experience to run the country. He's been in power for so long that it becomes difficult to imagine anybody else reaching his stature, Ms. Scheindlin adds, noting that Mr. Netanyahu is seen as a tough leader who knows how to take decisive action and manage relationships with Israel's allies. Carmel Market, a large open-air fruit and vegetable market on the south side of Tel Aviv, is known as a stronghold for the prime minister's Likud party. Alongside stacks of plump tomatoes and spices sold in bulk, people's opinions pile up alongside the produce in defense of Mr. Netanyahu. Everyone in the market knows what I think, and I'm not afraid to say he's the best. Avner Mizrahi, a greengrocer, boasts of his admiration for Mr. Netanyahu as he packs coriander and green onions in a bag. I am also a huge fan of Bibi, interjects Tikva Shanimov, a customer using Mr. Netanyahu's nickname. I will vote for him once again, she adds. Nobody can manage this country like Bibi with all our war fronts and all of the enemies we have in the world. Anshel Pfeffer, The Economist's Israel correspondent and author of Bibi, The Turbulent Life and Times of Benjamin Netanyahu, says the prime minister does not have a hold on the Israeli electorate, but on the Israeli system, and that, together with a lack of a clear challenger, makes him difficult to replace. If there was someone who could unite the very diverse opposition and challenge him, that would be a different story, he adds, saying that Mr. Netanyahu has learned to bend the system to his needs, breaking the rules or rewriting the rules of Israeli politics, and doing it again and again. A key part of the prime minister's career playbook has been acquiescing to the demands of his coalition partners, most notably political parties from the Jewish ultra-Orthodox community in Israel. Even during this time of war, ultra-Orthodox leaders insist that their young people be legally exempt from mandatory military service, which impacts most Jewish Israelis at age 18. This has become a major liability for Mr. Netanyahu in a country where young soldiers and reservists on extended tours of duty are dying in the name of national defense. In the past month, despite a declared ceasefire with Lebanon, more than a dozen soldiers have been killed, including one on Thursday. Keeping his current coalition intact going into the next election will be a priority for Mr. Netanyahu. Analysts say the prime minister is willing to make whatever deals might be necessary. This has included breaking longstanding taboos against appointing far-right ideologues as senior cabinet members. In interviews with more than a dozen of Mr. Netanyahu's supporters, several said they believe that the prime minister is facing deep state plots against him, and that he is still the most capable person to lead Israel through the most challenging period since its founding as a modern day state in 1948. Even the shaky ceasefire arrangement with Iran, which has left the Islamic Republic in power, and, as many Israelis see it, was imposed by the White House, does not deter Mr. Netanyahu's diehard supporters. Early this week, U.S. President Donald Trump reportedly cursed out the Israeli prime minister over a planned bombing of southern Beirut, just as the United States was trying to negotiate a peace deal with Lebanon and reach an accord with Iran. But the prime minister can still count on his enduring appeal that comes from an emotional level, says Tamar Herman, senior researcher at the Israel Democracy Institute, a Jerusalem think tank. He's kind of the father of the nation for many, she says. And again, this particular article was by Shoshana Solomon, who is a contributor at The Monitor, and Dina Kraft, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. Moving on to our second article from today's World section of The Monitor, the headline reads, "Women are the hands behind this cassava dish, Côte d'Ivoire's culinary heritage." In a suburb of Abidjan, teams of women make up highly efficient open-air production lines of atieke, Côte d'Ivoire's national dish. And I'm sorry if I pronounced that incorrectly. The date on this article is June the 4th. It is by Melanie Stetson Freeman, who is a staff photographer, and Colette Davidson, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. And the dateline is Anono, Côte d'Ivoire. On a wide avenue off the main road in this suburb of Abidjan, women sit fanned out in small groups, crouched over buckets as they chop and soak a homely brown root vegetable. Piles of what looks like couscous are spread across sheets of black plastic tarp. At first, the scene appears haphazard, but what I'm seeing are actually highly efficient open-air production lines of atieke, Côte d'Ivoire's national dish. In one corner, a woman in a flowery purple dress shaves off the rough skin of the cassava root. Another woman soaks the smooth white stalks in tubs of water. After the roots get ground down and fermented, the water is squeezed out from the pulp with a steel press. The granules then dry in the sun. A woman known as Madame Hortense, who operates one atieke production line, leads me into a simple cement house where a woman is shaking the granules in front of a fan to remove leftover fibers. Another stands sweating over a metal pot, turning the atieke with a wooden spatula as it steam cooks. Atieke can be paired with almost anything: fish, chicken, shrimp, boiled eggs, avocado, and is best eaten with your fingers, says Madame Hortense. It just tastes better that way. Atieke production employs upwards of an estimated 300,000 women, according to the Ivorian Ministry of Agriculture, and has pulled many out of poverty. In 2024, UNESCO recognized the skill in making the fermented cassava dish as Côte d'Ivoire's intangible cultural heritage. And though industrial production of atieke exists on a small scale here, the artisanal way of transforming cassava does not appear to be going anywhere anytime soon. "We do have machines that can do all this," says Madame Hortense, pointing toward a woman squatting on the ground, sifting atieke through a rectangular pan. "But people prefer the flavor of atieke when it's made like this, by hand." And a note here that Albane Ade contributed reporting for this article, which was written by Melanie Stetson Freeman, staff photographer, and Colette Davidson, a special correspondent, all at The Monitor. Continuing on in the World section of today's Monitor, our next headline reads, "Russia, a case study for sanctions not working as planned." If there's any country that shows sanctions unforeseeable consequences, it's one that has rebuilt self-sufficiency and forged new trade under pressure. The date on this article is June the 3rd. It is by Fred Weir, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor, and the dateline is Moscow. There are about 30 million foreign-branded cars on Russian roads, most of Western make. Dmitry Gorlov, who owns an automobile service center in Moscow, boasts that he can repair any of them. It's people such as him that kept the auto market in Russia stable after the start of Moscow's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, when Western car companies pulled out, shredding the warranties of Russian car owners and making it impossible to obtain producer-certified spare parts. "We used to get spare parts from the manufacturers or its designated provider," Mr. Gorlov said. "Now we get the same parts from China or from a number of Russian companies that have sprung up to fill a gap by illicitly making replacement parts. We can get anything we need." That helps to explain, more than 4 years after Western suppliers cut them off, millions of Russian drivers are still tooling around in American, European, and Japanese cars. It also hints at how Russian airlines continue flying their estimated 500 or so Boeing and Airbus planes, and how Russian energy producers managed to keep exploring and drilling for oil and gas. When Western leaders levied what has been described as the most intensive sanctions regime in history against Russia, starting in 2014 and intensifying after the invasion of Ukraine in 2022, they expected big effects. Results like economic sectors that were dependent on Western expertise being forced to shut down or at least to revert to more primitive forms of activity. Instead, the Russian economy rewired itself, developed alternatives for many of the Western goods it was suddenly deprived of, and in many cases found illegal ways of acquiring them. It rerouted supply chains and courted new markets. Where 15 years ago, Russia's biggest trading partner was the European Union, which bought Russian energy and sold back the full range of consumer goods, today's new pipelines carry Russian oil and gas to China. Instead of the empty shop shelves that many predicted, the same range of goods is available, but are now mostly homemade substitutes or from countries that refused to join the sanctions regime, mostly in Asia. Even if the war in Ukraine ended tomorrow, the changes wrought by sanctions on the configuration of Russia's economy, its relations with other countries, and arguably the shape of the global economic order looks permanent. Sanctions do have an impact. They damage and distort normal market relations, says Ivan Timofeev, director of the Russian International Affairs Council, a government-founded diplomatic think tank in Moscow. No one denies that it's very stressful, but Russia has largely adapted. By redirecting trade and reshaping domestic economic relations, we've survived. After growing robustly in the early years of the war, thanks to massive state military spending, Russia's economy has begun slowing down. Still, the International Monetary Fund predicts it will grow by 1.1% this year, which, ironically, is more than is forecast for major nations that are sanctioning Russia, including France, Germany, and the United Kingdom. The structural economic changes wrought by the war and sanctions have been sweeping, but the political shift may prove equally durable. Russia's foreign policy priority in the first decade of Vladimir Putin's reign was to improve relations with Europe. In recent years, China has become Moscow's key geopolitical partner, and it has poured resources into building alternative Russia-friendly associations of states such as the BRICS, B-R-I-C-S. Russia does not view sanctions as some sort of punishment for our supposed sins. We perceive sanctions as economic warfare waged against us with the purpose of destruction, says Dmitry Suslov, an expert with the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. Russia has come to view the West not merely as unreliable partners, but as adversaries bent on destroying us. The impact of sanctions has produced portentous surprises, such as Russia's massive trade surplus with longtime partner India, about $60 billion last year, which has the potential to reshape Indo-Russian relations permanently. India's currency controls make it difficult for Russian companies to repatriate their profits, so talks are underway to find mechanisms to either increase Indian exports to Russia or allow Russia to invest its growing stack of rupees into India. We've never had trade with Russia like we have today, says Nandan Unnikrishnan, an expert with the Observer Research Foundation, a Delhi-based think tank. It's mainly down to oil, but the increase has been exponential. Mr. Unnikrishnan says the devil is in the details, but the potential for a deeper Indo-Russian economic partnership is improving. It would be a good thing if the economic relationship became more diversified, and it might balance Russia's drift into China's embrace, he says. For its part, China has learned to insulate its banks and businesses from the threat of secondary sanctions for doing business with Russia, and the recent blockade of the Strait of Hormuz appeared to have focused Chinese minds on the benefits of building new energy pipelines from Russia that avoid such maritime choke points. China is largely self-sufficient in energy, but they've made it clear that they are really ready to absorb as much oil and gas as Russia can supply, says Sergei Sazonov, an expert with the Official Institute of China and Contemporary Asia in Moscow. The U.S.-led war in Iran appears to have accelerated many developments that were already underway, which will make the world a more comfortable place for Russia. That includes diversification of trading partners and efforts to establish payment systems that avoid the use of the dollar. The public discussion in India, since the Iran war started, is very clear, says Mr. Unnikrishnan. We need to reassess our relations with the U.S. and be sure to maintain our good ties with countries like Russia and not put all our eggs into any one basket. Even if President Donald Trump goes, the unreliable nature of the U.S. is likely to remain. And again, this particular article was by Fred Weir, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. Still in the world section of today's Monitor, our next headline reads, Iran war soured Gulf Arabs on Iraq. Can new leader in Baghdad win them back? Iraq was offering attractive opportunities for Gulf Arab economic and diplomatic initiatives, but the war made it a springboard for Iran-backed militia attacks. Can the country's young and untested prime minister navigate a multifaceted crisis? The date on this article is June the 2nd. It is by Taylor Luck, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. And the datelines are Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and Dubai, United Arab Emirates. Arab states in the Persian Gulf are worried about more than Iran. A common phrase being muttered by Gulf Arab officials and analysts is, "What do we do about Iraq?" Not long before the war, Iraq was the focus of perceived Gulf investment opportunities. But now the country, which neighbors the Gulf, has been torn between competing U.S. and Iranian spheres of influence. Heightening Gulf concerns, Iraqi territory has been used as a launching point for missiles and drones that are targeting key Gulf infrastructure, including Kuwaiti border posts, Saudi oil refineries, and an Emirati nuclear reactor. In short, Iran is galvanizing its Shiite militia proxies inside Iraq. Gulf states are demanding action. Saudi Arabia has launched missile strikes on Iraq, and the U.S. is losing patience. Amid these tensions, Iraq's newcomer prime minister, Ali al-Zayedi, a 40-year-old banking mogul endorsed by President Donald Trump, is rhetorically taking on the most powerful factions in Iraq, including the Iran-backed militias, calling on them to submit to the Iraqi government. Less than 2 weeks into his tenure, Mr. Zayedi, a relative unknown in political circles, is attempting to steer the country through an economic and diplomatic crisis that ranks as one of the most dangerous moments for Iraq since the 2003 U.S. invasion. His goal, observers say, is to repair relations with Iraq's Gulf neighbors, rein in the militias, and avoid having his country drag further into a regional war. Yet, he faces an uphill challenge that includes American and Iranian pressures and a skeptical Gulf. Just last fall, Iraq was experiencing a countrywide building boom under then-Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani's program of economic development and pragmatic politics. Detractors, however, say the oil-fueled spending spree did little to confront the rising influence of Shiite militias or curb corruption, an important issue for Gulf countries looking for evidence they can trust Baghdad. In November elections, Mr. Sudani's party gained the largest number of seats in parliament, but a court ruling barred him from forming a government coalition. Mr. Zayedi, a Shiite from southern Iraq, subsequently emerged as a consensus pick and took office in mid-May as Iraq's youngest ever prime minister. Neither Washington nor Tehran moved to veto the choice of Mr. Zayedi. He is taking the helm of a country reeling from its involvement in the war and from the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Oil exports make up 90% of Iraq's government revenues. Iran was once hesitant to destabilize Iraq, but its calculation has changed, says Dr. Renad Mansour, director of the Iraq Initiative at London-based Chatham House. Iran now sees Iraq as part of its war effort. Iraqi militias will seek to use Iraqi territory, and at the same time, the U.S. will continue to strike Iranian proxies in Iraq, he says. Iraq will continue to be a battleground, and the government does not have the sovereignty it would like to stop any of these attacks from happening. Within days of Mr. Zaidi's nomination, the United States urged him to confront and disarm the powerful militias, some of whom have political allies represented in his own coalition. Washington has levers at its disposal, namely declaring sanctions against members of the Iraqi government or withholding Iraq's oil revenues, which, due to an arrangement set up by the U.S. after its invasion of the country, are deposited at the U.S. Federal Reserve. Zaidi has to balance between the Iranians and the Americans, both of which have a significant influence on his everyday politics, says Dr. Mansour. From the American side, the push has been very clear. He needs to show progress on going after militias. From the Iranian side, its militias must continue to be able to operate from Iraq. He is stuck between these two very strong powers and will try to balance them, but it will be very difficult, Dr. Mansour notes. Last week, Mr. Zaidi called on the militias to integrate into the armed forces and come under government control. The Prime Minister was thrown a lifeline by the hardline nationalist Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, who declared late last week that his Shiite militiamen would integrate into the state security services, pressuring other militia leaders to do the same. Mr. Zaidi subsequently called on all armed factions to follow the same responsible national path and operate under the umbrella of the state and its official institutions. The move would guarantee the protection of Iraq, preserve its sovereignty, and strengthen security and stability based on the principle that the state is the sole authority entitled to monopolize arms and enforce the law, he said. Insiders say Mr. Zaidi has good relations across Iraq's fractious politics, including various Shiite, Sunni, and Kurdish political groups. The Prime Minister has indicated he wants to see a more balanced and independent Iraq with a diversified economy no longer solely reliant on oil. On Sunday, Mr. Zaidi suddenly announced he had turned down a $200 million bribe to cover up corruption in the oil ministry, announcing at a press conference that he was forming a corruption oversight body and would be reviewing all government contracts. It isn't clear what policies Zaidi would have because he's never held office, public office before, nor has he ever run in elections and campaigned on any specific policy, says Hamzeh Haddad, adjunct fellow at the Center for a New American Security. We know that foreign policy is at the top of the agenda as Iraq finds itself in the middle of a war with a precarious ceasefire. For leaders in the Gulf, Mr. Zaidi remains an unknown who must prove his commitment to preventing the country from being used as a springboard for Iranian attacks. They want action, not just statements. Shiite militias, ideologically driven and allied with Tehran as part of what Iran considers its anti-U.S. and anti-Israel axis of resistance, have proven resistant to previous attempts by Iraqi political factions and security services to bring them under control. In addition to targeting Gulf Arab states, the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, and American military bases, the militias have struck Iraq's oil and gas infrastructure, Baghdad International Airport, and the headquarters of the Iraqi National Intelligence Services, killing one officer. Iraqi militias and their political allies have gained positions of power in recent years. Militia-aligned political parties also won seats in the November 2025 elections. It is not like we have a government in Baghdad that has the tools to control all these militias, says Dr. Muhannad Selum, assistant professor of international politics and security at the Doha Institute for Graduate Studies and non-resident fellow at the Middle East Council on Global Affairs. No one entity has control on the ground, he said. Gulf Arab officials remain pessimistic that any Iraqi government can exert full control over the country. The Iraqi government has proven time and again it doesn't run the show in Iraq, says an official who did not wish to be named, describing Gulf governments as being burned by previous pledges. Who do we have to go to and stop these attacks? There is no state, only dozens of factions. This lack of faith in Baghdad is expressed despite the possibility that Iraq could become a critical hub for a post-Hormuz Middle East. Iraq's planned road and rail project linking to Turkey, often referred to as the Development Road Project, would allow Gulf exports to reach Europe more easily. Observers say a path remains open for Mr. Zaidi to save ties with Iraq's Gulf neighbors and prevent the country from being dragged into conflict further. In its bid to woo the Gulf, Iraq always pushed economic interests, says Dr. Mansour, but economic opportunity is proving to be linked to security and stability. The government will have to try and find ways to use the rule of law to stop some of these attacks, he said. In order to maintain neutrality in the war, observers say, Baghdad's newcomer prime minister will have to take decisive and risky action. As for improving relations with Gulf states, the Iraqi government under Zaidi needs to be proactive in its stated neutral policy, says Mr. Haddad, the analyst. Under the former prime minister Sudani, neutrality meant doing nothing and hoping for the best. For Zaidi, he needs to be proactive in preventing attacks on neighbors and allies from all sides. And again, this particular article was by Taylor Luck, who is a special correspondent at the Monitor. With that, we're going to move right along to the USA section of today's Monitor and pick up our first headline, which reads, "In Trump's second term, financial gain has become a defining feature." The Trump family's wealth has surged over the 19 months since Donald Trump's election. The circumstances are revealing how, on personal finance matters, a president might be constrained less by laws than by norms that are vulnerable to testing. The date on this article is June the 5th. It is by Linda Feldman, who is a staff writer at The Monitor, and the dateline is Washington, D.C. On matters of personal and family money, President Donald Trump appears to be playing by a different rule book from other presidents, and even from his own first term in office. By his own admission, he feels little pressure to restrict family business dealings simply because of his role in government. A tide of actions reflect the trend. Investors have pumped vast sums into Trump family members' business interests. Projects such as the White House Ballroom are being funded by donors who have dealings with the government. Agencies have granted no-bid contracts to Trump-friendly firms. And in the 19 months since his election, the personal fortunes of the president and his family have soared. To President Trump's detractors, it's unprecedented self-enrichment and corruption, or at the very least, a failure to follow norms upheld by past occupants of the Oval Office. To defenders, including his cabinet, staff, and base supporters, the criticism is politically motivated, aimed at punishing a president who they say is transparent in his dealings and follows all applicable laws. While Mr. Trump's first term had its share of headlines about conflicts of interest questions, the amounts of money involved have surged in term two, notably in cryptocurrencies and other relatively new business interests for the Trump family. The voting public is more focused on issues affecting their own pocketbooks than on the president. But as the nation celebrates its 250th birthday, the tension over financial ethics represents a test for American democracy under a president like no other. The number of entanglements, the volume of money, it's staggering, says William Howell, dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Government and Policy in Washington. This week has also shown that Mr. Trump's financial gambits still face some constraints. Under pressure from Congress, including a number of Republicans, as well as from the courts, his administration appeared to back down Tuesday on the creation of a nearly $1.8 billion anti-weaponization fund designed to compensate those he says were mistreated by the federal government. On Wednesday, though, when asked about the fund by a reporter, the president says, "I love it." Asked to clarify whether it was dead or just on pause, he said, "I'd have to ask the lawyers," suggesting he hasn't given up on the fund altogether. The administration rejects the view that the Trump presidency is rife with conflicts of interest, calling critics' attacks unfair. This is the same tired narrative that Democrats have pushed against President Trump, his family, and his administration for a decade, says Anna Kelly, White House Principal Deputy Press Secretary, in a written statement to the Monitor. President Trump only acts in the best interests of the American public, which is why they overwhelmingly reelected him to this office, despite years of lies and false accusations against him and his businesses from the fake news media. There are no conflicts of interest. Across a range of activities, the Trump family has been expanding business ventures with profitable connections to the government, all in plain sight. One eye-popping headline is the spike in Mr. Trump's net worth since seeking and winning re-election, from $2.3 billion early in 2024 to $6.2 billion today, according to Forbes. The extraordinary gains come primarily from his business interests, which include vast real estate holdings, licensing deals, merchandise such as Trump watches, Bibles, and sneakers, but also, increasingly, cryptocurrency. The Trump Organization says the president handed control of the family businesses to his sons when he retook office. Trump family members, too, have seen their net worth soar in the second term. By late September, the family, including wife Melania, his children, and son-in-law Jared Kushner, a private equity investor, was worth some $10 billion, nearly doubling since the 2024 election, Forbes reports. By December of 2025, eldest son Donald Trump Jr. was worth some $300 million, up from $50 million in November of 2024, and son Eric's Trump's net worth was up tenfold to about $400 million, also per Forbes. This rapid spike in family wealth represents a marked departure from the first term when Mr. Trump said he prohibited family members from engaging in international business activity. In the second term, he told the New York Times in January, there are no such restraints. I prohibited them from doing business in my first term, and I got absolutely no credit for it, Mr. Trump said. I don't have to do that, and it's really unfair to them. Presidential family members have a long history of apparent trading on the family name for financial gain, including former President Joe Biden's son Hunter Biden and brothers James and Frank Biden. But scholars and ethics watchdogs say such examples pale in scope compared with the Trump era. He is sui generis in that we have not had an American president with a business enterprise of this scale and scope, writes historian Julian Zelizer of Princeton University in an email. The Latin phrase means unique. He is the first U.S. president never to have served in prior public office or the military. He is only the second to serve non-consecutive terms, and with an interregnum that allowed him and his allies to plan for a second term centered on an aggressive interpretation of executive branch powers. What's more, Mr. Trump's background is both a brash businessman and reality TV performer, operating on gut and instinct and always on the lookout for leverage, set the president up for a second term that has pushed constitutional and legal boundaries as well as norms of governance. And unlike in the first term, he has surrounded himself with advisors and staff known for not much pushback. But there's more to it than that, Professor Zelizer adds, including a sense of acceptance or resignation within the populace regarding enormous presidential powers. The collapse of efforts to constrain the role of money in politics, the thin rules that exist on ethics for presidents, the reliance on informal norms, and the normalization of corporate lobbying all create a culture that numbs many Americans to what's happening, he writes. Last week, investigative news outlet ProPublica reported that the White House had intervened last year to get a $620 million deal for an obscure rare earth magnet company with ties to Donald Trump Jr. The president's son denied involvement, according to the report, which cites an unnamed Pentagon official as saying it was White House trade advisor Peter Navarro who intervened on behalf of the company. A drone company in which Mr. Trump's older sons have an investment stake, also received a Pentagon contract. Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump have also announced a variety of lucrative real estate and cryptocurrency deals in the U.S. and places such as the Middle East that stand to benefit both them and their father. Don does not interface with the federal government as part of his role with any company that he invests in or advises. Sandy Sarabian, a spokesman for Donald J. Trump Jr., writes in an email to the Monitor. The president himself drew attention last month when his latest federal financial disclosure form revealed more than 3,700 stock trades in just the first 3 months of this year, transactions totaling tens of millions of dollars. His company, the Trump Organization, has stated that his investment holdings are managed by an independent third party. Even so, such trading in individual stocks by a sitting president is unheard of in the modern era, and the news stirred a host of new questions about apparent conflicts of interest. One example, Mr. Trump bought more than $1 million in Dell Technologies stock earlier this year, around the same time that he also urged Americans to go out and buy a Dell. This also came after company founder Michael Dell and his wife announced a $6.25 billion donation to fund U.S. government Trump accounts for children. Last week, the Pentagon announced a $9.7 billion contract with the company. In March, about a month into the Iran war, Mr. Trump announced productive conversations with Iran, causing oil stocks and futures to plummet. His brokerage account then spent the day buying oil stocks. When it comes to public money, there are limits, both legally and politically, as to what the president can do, as seen with his now scuttled anti-weaponization fund. Bipartisan groups in both houses of Congress, including some senior Trump allies, had worked to kill the fund. Watchdogs called it unlawful since it was created as part of an unusual settlement with the IRS over a leak of Mr. Trump's tax returns, in which the president was both plaintiff and defendant as head of the executive branch. The fund also lacked congressional authorization. Also stirring concern, among potential beneficiaries were Trump supporters who stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Still in place, though, is a settlement provision that would bar the IRS from auditing past tax returns filed by Mr. Trump or his family. That part alone could save him a reported $100 million if he were found guilty of fraudulent tax practices. On May 29th, a federal judge in Florida reopened the Trump lawsuit against the IRS to determine whether it was an abuse of the court system. Whether all of these Trump actions constitute corruption is in the eye of the beholder. Some presidential conduct is more a matter of norms and customs than law, say experts on American governance. And under the Constitution, the legislative and judicial branches of government are empowered to serve as a check on presidential power. Public opinion is another potential check on presidential behavior, though less so now that Mr. Trump is in his second term and will not appear again on a ballot. After the midterm elections in November, seen in part as a referendum on the president, he might feel even less beholden to voters. Over time, as Mr. Trump's average job approval ratings in polls have declined to 38%, negative characterizations have risen. A YouGov poll released in March found that majorities of Americans see him as arrogant, 65%, opportunistic, 57%, and corrupt, 54%. In the second Trump term, ethical oversight has diminished. He declined to issue the ethics pledge he took for his first term, and he rescinded the presidential ethics rules his predecessor, President Biden, had adopted. The U.S. Office of Government Ethics, which aims to prevent conflicts of interest within the executive branch, has been operating without a permanent leader after Mr. Trump fired the director early in 2025. though the president is largely exempt from OGE oversight. In addition, a 2024 Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity, which shields the chief executive from prosecution for official acts, can be interpreted broadly, potentially adding to a sense of invincibility. Also important is the decades-long rise among conservative thought leaders of unitary executive theory, which holds that the U.S. president has sole authority over the executive branch. This theory was a driving force behind Project 2025, the blueprint for a second term drawn up by Trump allies, some of whom now occupy top roles in his administration. At heart, though, the money-making aspect of Mr. Trump goes directly to his unique persona as president. He's forever been wheeling and dealing before he entered public life, with an appetite for wealth and a certain kind of lifestyle, says Professor Howell, co-author of the 2025 book, Trajectory of Power, The Rise of the Strongman Presidency. To truly make sense of Mr. Trump's modus operandi, Professor Howell adds, one must consider the incredible demands for loyalty that course through this administration. The question is, how do you sustain those kinds of demands? Part of it is through threat, he said. Part of it, too, is the possibility of favor. Matthew Wilson, a political scientist at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, sees echoes of the late 19th century Gilded Age in today's wheeler-dealer atmosphere. But for many Americans struggling with the cost of living and other everyday matters, Mr. Trump's finances aren't a top concern. This is especially so in these polarized times, Professor Wilson says, when voters tend to forgive politicians on their own side accused of wrongdoing or see such accusations as a partisan witch hunt. Professor Wilson lays out the thought process. Whether Trump has shady cryptocurrency deals going on or not doesn't really make any difference to the cost of my health insurance or to the level of crime in my community. In the end, he says, worrying about the appearance or reality of presidential self-enrichment is, to some voters, a luxury for affluent people. And once again, this particular article was by Linda Feldman, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Moving on to our second headline from today's World section of The Monitor. This one reads, Trump drops anti-weaponization fund after rare Republican pushback. The White House dropped a $1.8 billion fund set up to pay people who claim the federal government was, quote, weaponized against them. The date on this article is June the 2nd. It is by Caitlin Babcock, who is a staff writer at The Monitor, and the dateline is Washington. The Trump administration on Tuesday backed down from its $1.8 billion anti-weaponization fund after facing Republican backlash in Congress. We're not moving forward with the fund, period, said acting attorney, U.S. Attorney General Todd Blanche at a White House hearing Tuesday. Multiple Republicans balked at the fund, objecting to the possibility it could be used to pay rioters who assaulted police officers at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. The administration's decision could clear the way for Republicans to move forward with a high-priority reconciliation bill to pay for immigration enforcement. Creation of the fund, which would have used taxpayer money to pay damages to people from any political party who say the federal government was weaponized against them, led to a rare Republican revolt against President Donald Trump's priorities and stalled the bill's progress. It remains unclear whether the White House's promise will satisfy the senators who oppose the fund, as there was no consensus on how they wanted to see it addressed. The fund was originally part of a deal Mr. Trump reached with the IRS that included immunity from audits on already filed tax returns for him, his family, and his businesses. During questioning Tuesday from Democrats, Mr. Blanche indicated that immunity would remain in place. The $1.8 billion fund, however, had been the main focus of objections for some senators. Before the hearing on Tuesday afternoon, that opposition had created uncertainty about whether Republicans had the votes to move forward with the bill this week to fund Immigration and Customs Enforcement and other immigration agencies for the rest of the president's term. Everything comes down to a function of math, because we have we have to have Republicans hanging together, Senate Majority Leader John Thune of South Dakota said. Tuesday's discussion on Capitol Hill came days after a federal judge in one of four cases attempting to block the fund paused its advancement pending a hearing next week. On Monday, the Justice Department announced it would abide by the judge's order. The administration, however, did not specify whether it planned to go forward with the fund. That didn't sit well with several Republicans. On Tuesday, as Republican senators left their weekly caucus lunch, they gave few details on their conversations and little clue as to how the DOJ's statement would affect progress or timing on the reconciliation bill. Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana said they had no information from the White House. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky said he didn't know when reconciliation could be taken up, either this week or next, he said. But several senators suggested Mr. Blanche's testimony would be worth watching. I think his statements will be very definitive, very clear, and create the certainty that I hope all of our members and House members need, Mr. Thune told reporters outside the Senate chambers. The Senate Majority Leader must now determine whether there are enough Republican votes to pass the nearly $72 billion reconciliation bill. Democrats plan to vote in unity against it, so the defection of even a small handful of Republican senators would be enough to stymie progress. Even if Republicans were able to move the bill forward without a provision targeting the fund, Democrats plan to put forward amendments to kill or restrict the fund in order to make Republicans vote on them. Some of the amendments could get enough Republican votes to pass. Democrats say they want additional restrictions on the fund as part of the reconciliation bill, claiming the Trump White House cannot be taken at its word. Any promise from Trump is worthless, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York said Tuesday morning. The first amendment I will offer on the Republican reconciliation bill will be to ban Trump's slush fund permanently and to revoke his family's free reign to commit tax fraud forever. The Justice Department created the Anti-Weaponization Fund under highly unusual circumstances. The DOJ created the fund as part of a settlement in a lawsuit Mr. Trump filed in January against his own government, specifically the Internal Revenue Service, over the leak of his tax returns during his first term. There doesn't appear to be precedent for a president suing their own government, and the judge in the case has been set to probe that issue this summer. Though Mr. Trump was bringing the case in his personal capacity, U.S. District Judge Kathleen Williams of Florida wrote in an April 24th order, he is the sitting president and his named adversaries are in entities whose decisions are subject to his direction. Accordingly, it is unclear to this court whether the parties are sufficiently adverse to each other so as to satisfy Article III's case or controversy requirement, she added. She later appointed three independent lawyers to help examine that question and has ordered the parties to file briefs on the question by May 20th. 2 days before the deadline, Mr. Trump informed the court that he was withdrawing the case voluntarily. Because the decision was coming so early in the litigation, the president wrote, it didn't need to be approved by Judge Williams or by the IRS judge, by the IRS. Judge Williams then dismissed the case, though she rebuked the IRS for never filing any motion in the case, thus allowing it to be voluntarily dismissed. Hours after the case was dismissed, the Justice Department announced a settlement agreement with Mr. Trump and his family. As part of the settlement, the agency revealed that it would establish the $1.776 billion anti-weaponization fund. The fund would be paid out by the department's judgment fund, federal money set aside to pay for court judgments and settlements against the United States. On Tuesday, Democratic Representative Grace Meng of New York pressed Mr. Blanche as to whether the administration was prepared to put something in writing or use another vehicle to assure Americans that the fund was dead. Mr. Blanche simply repeated that the White House would not move forward with the fund and said the transcript of the hearing meant it would be in writing. And a note here that staff writer Henry Gass contributed to this report, which was written by Caitlin Babcock, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. With that, we're going to jump over to the editorials section of the Monitor and pick up a editorial headline. The headline reads, "A Gift for Ukraine's Future in Europe." After a big election shift, Hungary signaled a go-ahead for Kyiv to start talks about joining the European Union, possibly giving Ukraine a political shield against Russia. The date on this comment is June the 4th. It is by the Monitor's editorial board. Like a family, the European Union has had a fair share of black sheep among its members. Britain left the Union. Poland long thumbed its nose at EU standards for the rule of law. Greece lied about its deficit and almost sank the bloc's economy. On Wednesday, Hungary, after years of being on the outs with the EU, returned to the fold like a prodigal son. A new prime minister of the Central European nation, Péter Magyar, strongly signaled that he would permit Ukraine to start formal talks to join the EU. He said Kyiv had agreed to new cultural, educational, and political protections for tens of thousands of ethnic Hungarians living in Ukraine's western Zaporizhia region. Ukraine's talks with the EU are now slated to begin in mid-June, more than 4 years after it applied to be an official candidate following the 2022 Russian invasion. Mr. Magyar's tentative support for Ukraine's membership reverses a veto on such notions by his predecessor, Viktor Orban. That longtime authoritarian leader had used the issue of the minority Hungarians to stall Kyiv's bid. His party lost big in an April election as Hungarians shifted back toward European values. Along with its recent battlefield successes, Ukraine might now gain a stronger political shield against Russia's aggression. Hungary's decision brings us closer to our joint European future, says Taras Kashka, Ukraine's deputy minister for European integration, according to Euronews. During his election campaign, Mr. Magyar said that European leaders had viewed Hungary as an unnecessary troublemaker, more aligned with Moscow than with Brussels. Next week, he plans to meet with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. The two leaders will have one common interest, embracing the EU's hope that the continent does not once again allow ethnic differences to start wars. And again, this particular piece was a comment by the Monitor's editorial board. With that, I'm afraid we have come to the end of our time together today. As always, I appreciate you joining me to listen to a variety of articles from the Christian Science Monitor. Stay safe, stay well, stay hopeful, and I'll be back with you with more from the Christian Science Monitor next week. Thank you for listening.